Yeah, but the goal is to start the Mishnah, the first Mishnah tomorrow, and start understanding the nature of Vedika and its connection to Biur. But before we do that, I wanted to do one more day of broader concepts now that we move on from Sukkim. And I want to take up a question that Kobe asked yesterday. You want to remind us what you asked yesterday, Kobe? Yes, I do. But you came back for more, so I don't know. You know, this is on you. Yesterday, Kobe asked, right? We said that if you look at the Pesukim and you look at the Rambam, right? That what? Yeah, right. It seems like some of the mitzvot that we deal with in the laws of chametz are siyagim, right? Are fences. Are protective measures against other. Now, as Kobe said, that's a little bit odd. Why is that odd, Kobe? Good, right? Is that we usually think about mitzvot, right? Anything that's biblical as being independently valuable, right? So, like a normal siyag, right, is usually when we say a siyag, what we mean is a rabbinic law. So, the first mission in Pirkei Avot, the third thing that the Anshei Knesset Gedolah said, Asu Siyag LaTorah, make fences around the Torah, we mean rabbinic laws that are protecting you. And we understand that there's intrinsic value to the biblical prohibition, and you're protecting it with layers of rabbinic prohibition. But what is odd about Chametz is that we have, as we already saw very clearly in the Rambam, there is this intuition that the prohibition of eating Chametz on Pesach is the primary prohibition, somehow. And then we have all these other prohibitions around it. Don't see it, don't find it, don't eat it before Pesach. All these things that seem to be around it, which conceptually seem ancillary, and yet we don't normally see this type of language in D'oraita. So what I want to deal with today is two questions. One is there such a thing? And is there such a thing as layered biblical law, right? Where even though more than one of the prohibitions is itself biblical, still there's a recognition that they are not of the same level, right? That their relationship is one of primary prohibition with protective prohibitions. And the second, which is even more general, which is why is chametz and the laws around chametz so absurdly strict, right? They are so strict, not just in many ways. One is that the number of mitzvot that are associated with its destruction, rooting out, is more than what we have pretty much anywhere else. Where between the derabanan and the deoraita of bittul and bidika, right, of nullifying it and searching for it and destroying it. And not having it in your house and like you have a million prohibitions, plus the fact that it has unique laws in terms of nullification. So while most prohibitions midoraita are batel b'rov, right, in majority midarabanan in shishim, right, you need 60. The halacha by chametz is when, how can you nullify chametz?
Small.
You can't, right? You can't. Afilo be'alef lo batel. If the chametz, you are correct, that if the chametz becomes inedible to the point where a dog wouldn't eat it, it's no longer defined as chametz. But if something is defined as chametz, what? No, you have changed it from being chametz. Right? It's no longer chametz. So bittul is where it's numerically nullified, where it is what it is, but it becomes numerically nullified. Yeah, you're making a chilen, some milk splashes in. Right, if it's less than 160 parts, you can eat it, despite the fact that it's not going to eat. It's yeah, it's batel. It's nullified. It doesn't matter. Right, the milk. Right, but normally, if the milk wasn't batel, you would have affected the child. No, that's called ein mevatlin israel chatchila. You're not allowed to into lechatchila. But Avi had a question first. Once it mixes it is, yeah. Once it mixes in, yes.
So
So that is a complicated Isser call. That is a complicated Isser called Kama Kama Batil, right? So sometimes we say Kama Kama Batil, which means each one becomes Batil, and then we have a principle that at certain points, Chozer V'Neyor, it then reawakens. That's a complicated sugya. I'm not going to do that right now. But just know that, yes, one of the major questions in Hilchot Kashrut is the parameters of Kama Kama Batel and Chozer V'Neyor, and when they apply, and what Isurim, and how exactly, and etc. So, yes, that is a very good question. It depends how you read that second mission, the Mishnah, first mission, the second parak of Pirkei Avot, right? Where the Mishnah says, right, have a zahir b'mitzvah kalav v'chachamora she'iyata yodeh matan scharen shal mitzvot, right? Be as careful with a light mitzvah as a stringent mitzvah, because you don't know how strict they are. And then you can read that Mishnah in two ways. One is the way you are, is that they are different layers, but there's an epistemic gap, right? We don't know, right? Or you can read that ontologically, right? That you don't know because there, at a fundamental level, there is no difference, right? Which is the simplest one, to be fair, is that this is an epistemic claim rather than an ontological one. Epistemic is having to do with your knowledge, right? Essential, right? Meaning, epistemology is the study of knowledge, how we know things, right? Ontology, the study of essences. Sorry. A few more weeks in Ray Ginsburg and you'll in his philosophy, whatever, you'll be fine. Okay, good. So Avi says, well, why not? Why shouldn't we have it, right? So these are the two questions I want to deal with, which is, one, why is Chametz so strict? And two is, is what seems to be happening in fact true? Avi says, well, why shouldn't it be? Right? Why shouldn't you assume that certain Isurim are so strict that the Torah itself will layer it? Right? Why not? Right? Why can't God be the model for this idea of protective measures against mitzvot? Right? If, in fact, there are things which are so strict, and that's why these are two related questions, right? One is to figure out, is that what the Torah is doing? And the second is, what is it about Chametz that makes it so overwhelmingly weird, right? Now, when you think about it, if you take these rules straightforwardly, it leads to very, very radical conclusions, right? So, for example, when I was in yeshiva, someone asked Rav Lichtenstein, and he said, so if you take the rule literally, right, that chametz afil be'elef lo batel, that you can never be mevatel chametz, so does that mean that if anyone feel like being halachically nefarious? Mordechai, I always wanted to be halachically nefarious. So Mordechai says, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to the Kinneret, from which we get our drinking water, and I'm going to take a single cookie, and I'm going to crumble up a single cookie, thereby forbidding the entire water source for all of Israel for Pesach, right? That is what a literal application of that rule should lead to, that Mordechai can do that. Thanks, Mordechai. No, really no. Appreciate it. Right? When someone asked Rav Lichtenstein whether it's true, and Rav Lichtenstein said no, right? There has to be, at some point, a line where we don't call this bittel anymore, we call it non-existent. Like, there has to be some line, I don't know where it is, right, where that's not even bittel, it just doesn't exist, right? Like, has yesh rule somewhere, because otherwise you can't drink water anywhere. Someone at some point threw a cookie in the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, right? Like, there is no water source in the world where someone hasn't thrown a cookie. What? So what? Correct. So, I mean, I don't know. Do we use, like, the standard celiac, right? 20 parts per million, right? I don't know, right? If you ever see that, by the way, that's what that means, right? If it says, right, can be eaten by celiacs 20 ppm, right? That's 20 parts per million or less, right? So again, Chametz has different rules. Before Pesach, yes. On Pesach, he went on a Cholamoy trip. Cholamoy trip. Cholamoy trip, he decided to throw a cookie into the Kinneret just to mess everyone up. What? He did it Seder night, okay? Before he went to the Seder, he saved a cookie, okay? He's quite... Okay. Fine. Forget Mordechai, okay? This is the new plan by Hamas, okay? Halachic terrorism, okay? The second Pesach starts, right? They take chametz, okay? Come up with what you want. I don't know. What? Yeah, this will go in my the book I want to write one day of mystery novels for very, very niche from populations.
But if
yes.
they got more than 1/60th worth of chametz,
so now we have halachic terrorism. You know, I've already told you that I want to write a mystery novel in which the criminal is a disgruntled shadchan who steals everyone's identity using those ridiculous resumes that they give in yeshivish dating circles, right? You know, I have all types of ideas just to deal with the absurdity. What?
Yes, and I have time for this.
Okay, I'll get my first, let me publish my first halakhic book, and then we'll move to, what?
Yeah.
You know, I think it's a few months until that book comes out, and then after that I'm free to write absurdity.
I think a lot of people have actually heard that.
Yeah, you know, I've thought that before. I don't know how good I'd be at a fiction writer. I need, you know, I had a roommate in yeshiva who was really, really good at it, but, you know, who was a big Talmud Chacham and really, really good at creative writing, but, you know. Oh, yeah. Yes, I know. Yeah, add Tashlich. Yes, add Tashlich to the mix. Okay, good. But anyways, so project for the year is from fiction. There are people who do this. Rav Chaim Sabata was one of the Rosh Yeshiva at Birkat Moshe or Mala Adumim, and he's also written several fiction books. Yeah, like award-winning, like the Israel equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize winning fiction books.
I actually read an interesting fiction book of a boy who lived during the time of Jeroboam in his kingdom. I don't know what it's called.
Yeah, I have it. The Spitzes wrote it.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, so there is a family in Alongswit that did this. They wrote a bunch of historical fictions from Tanakh. Sometimes. And Rabbi Gideon Rothstein did that also. Okay, anyways. We have gone far afield here, guys. Okay, good. So, which source do you want to do first? I've given you today just two sources. The Radbaz deals with the general question, which is why is chametz chaos?
I know we just got off this topic, but if you model it to make the Kinneret chametz, they would need to put more than 66,666,666,666,666 liters of chametz into the Kinneret.
No, what do you mean? It's not batel. It, no matter how little it is, the simple shot is it's never batel. A single cookie.
No, but now it is. Because someone's right. Done that, and it's not
funny. Well, that was exactly the Shaila. That was the...
He was just joking around. Like,
yeah, that was the point. That was the point. Is that
I know. Right? As in it's so
we have gone so far afield here.
So
that was Rav Lichtenstein's argument, but that's a Chiddush. I mean, I think he has to be right, but otherwise he'd be crazy. Of course he has to be right, otherwise he'd be crazy. I mean, to be fair, there are people who won't drink water from a tap. On Pesach. Yes, going back to, who mentioned it, that chametz before Pesach is batel? Wait, who mentioned that chametz before? Right, so chametz before Pesach is batel. And therefore, like I know, you mentioned that, right? Yeah. Right, so I have a Chabad cousin that they won't have water from the tap on Pesach. But they will put all the water in the bathtub before Pesach, because then you can be mevatel it before Pesach, and you only drink from that. Or a million water bottles and whatever. You know,
wait, what's the batel again?
Nullified. So before Pesach, it is nullified. On Pesach, it's not.
Before Pesach, it's nullified.
So before Pesach, you can chametz can become nullified. So if it gets mixed into a mixture in the right quantities, it will halachically be insignificant. On Pesach, it can't be. Right? Okay, good. So I give you two sources, the Radbaz and the Lekach Tov. So, Mordechai, I expect that since you already know that I'm going to do this, who is the Radbaz? Late 1400s, 1500s, correct. 14 to 1500s, 15th, 16th century, correct. What's his name? Very good. David Ibn Zimra. Now, the Radbaz stands for Ben Zimra, but he was Ibn. There you go. The chicken saint. Sure, great. Yes, he is one of the most prolific authors of response in the medieval period. He writes thousands. What? Radbaz. What? Over 3,000 tshuvot. That's a lot. Okay? If you think about what that is, that's a lot.
Like just answers to silos.
Yes. That's a lot. What? Yes. And you need to get to the point, A, where you're a significant of posek, right? That people are asking those questions. Then you have to write these halachic essays to respond to each question. Yes. He writes a lot. I mean, the Rajba writes more, I think. Yes. Tshuvot are very uneven. Right? Tshuvot, right? She'ilot v'tshuvot, right? Response to literature where people asked you a question, you responded, are very uneven. So some of the most important poskim wrote like, I don't know, like the Truman Adeshen, right? Who's super important, wrote 345 tshuvot, right? The Radbaz writes 10 times that. The Rajba writes like 20 times that, 15, 20 times that. You know, certain people like Rav Shaul Nathanson wrote like 5,000 tshuvot, the Sholom Meshiv, right? But most of these like very famous tshuvah svarim have like 100 tshuvot, 200 tshuvot, 300 tshuvot. But then there's people like the Rabbis who have 3,000 tshuvot. Yeah. Or like in modern poskim you have it also. So Moshe Feinstein has 9 volumes of Tshuvot, 2 which were published posthumously. The Tzitzeliezer has at least 21 volumes of Tshuvot. And each Tshuvot is like 5 times the length of any Tshuvot, you know. In the Sholem Meshiv, yes. In most Tshuvot, not so much. Anyways, so the Radbaz deals with the question of why Chametz is so machmir, and the Lekach Tov, Yosef Engel, who is a fascinating person. Did anyone look up who the Lekach Tov is? Who Rabbi Yosef Engel is? So, what? So Rabbi Yosef Engel. Wait, what happened to this? My computer's going crazy. Rabbi Yosef Engel is, I'll get you his exact years. And he's pretty recent. Yeah, 1859 to 1920. Okay? He's Polish, and he writes very interesting books. One of them is Lekach Tov. One of them is most famous is Asvun Daraisa, or Atvun Daraisa, or whatever you want to call it. He also wrote Beit HaOtzar, which is a very impressive work. Beit HaOtzar is a halachic encyclopedia. It's several volumes long, except he died at letter Bet.
What?
Yes, you heard me right. It is an encyclopedia, several volumes long, but he only got through part of Aleph and Bet.
How do you know it's several volumes long?
So there's nothing.
What?
How do you know it's several volumes long?
Just what we have
is several volumes long.
Just Aleph and Bet is several volumes long. That's my point.
It's a very long encyclopedia.
What?
It's
probably more than. I mean, he died in 1920. No, I'm sure he could, but that was what he wrote. Anyways. Okay. So what do you say? Why is Chametz... So let's start with the first question. Why is Chametz so machmir? Okay? So the Radbaz mentions 3 reasons. Yes? The Radbaz says there are 3 reasons why Chametz is uniquely stringent. What are they? One, he says, is that eating chametz on Pesach carries with it a chiyuv kari, which already tells you that it's a big deal, right? What? Right. One second. Let's just, right? But one is that it's an Isur Karet. And in general, we know that by Isur Karet, we are more stringent. Fine? That's one.
Wait, can you reverse that? Can you say that?
Yes, it's an Isur Karet, and therefore we are more stringent. Or can you say that it's such a stringent law that there's an Isur Karet associated with it?
Well, remember, the Radbaz, after giving three reasons, is going to say none of this is sufficient, right? Wow. But let's just say, do what he says. The first thing he says is, okay, it's Karet. Now, you're right. You could just reverse it and say, well, wait a second. Why is it so strict that it requires Karet? But this at least answers the question of why you might need protective measures, right? It is stringent. Right? Why it's stringent, leave it aside. But why are there so many protective measures? Because it's stringent, it's Karet. Okay? That's one reason. What's a second? What? Right, it has Isur Hana'ah, right, that practically it is also more stringent. Not only does it carry a weightier punishment, but unlike, let's say, Basar V'Chalav, or Treif, or Dvarim Tmeim, which are all regular things, regular Isurim, and you can't eat them, but you can benefit from them. You cannot benefit from Chametz on Pesach, right? And what's his third? Very practical. Right? Is lo bedile in shemine. What is lo bedile in shemine? People aren't used to separating from it. Right? And therefore what? Right? If it's around, right? Like if someone accidentally has a cheeseburger sitting on their dining room table for whatever reason, you know not to eat it. Right? Like you're used to not eating. Right? You know, there's like that. That momentary hesitation when you're at a kosher restaurant and they give you a cheeseburger with either fake cheese or fake meat, and there's like that moment. Sometimes you're like, "Yes, this right." I was at the wedding I was at 2 days ago. It's like they had like a stand where they were making like flatbreads with like meat on top, and next to it was flatbreads with, I guess, fake cheese and vegetables and pizza. And it took me a second. I'm like, is this a dairy wedding? Right? Like, we know, right? It looks like meat and milk, and you, right, react. If someone gave you pork, you would.
Did it taste like
regular cheese? Yeah, pretty much, actually. Yeah, I was surprised. What? It had a hefsher on every stand. Didn't like have, like, literally it had like a little hexer on every table. Yeah, like a little thing. Yes. So you find, yeah, I don't think I've ever seen that in America, but here sometimes you see it. My favorite hexerim here though are the ones on Hanukkah gelt. Because the Badatz Eid HaCharedus stamps the hexer. It's the mold of the chocolate is in the shape of the hexer. it's very, very,
that's like chocolate letters of like kosher mahadran.
No, it's just stamped in. But then you'd need them all together to figure out that it was kosher. But chametz, on the other hand, you are used to eating it, right? And therefore, you need to be more careful. Now, there is another prohibition that does have certain stringencies that are related to exactly. There are several other prohibitions that are stricter because lo bedile in shemine. So, for example, basar b'chalav, right? A cheeseburger, fine. You know not to eat it. But meat and milk at the same table, right? You're not allowed to have meat and milk at the same table, right? You need some sort of separation, right? You need some sort of separation because the milk is kosher, the meat is kosher, and therefore lo bedile in shemine. Yes. Because you would be used to, right? Because you would be used to separating from it. It also happens to be that it would not make it basar b'chalav. Basar b'chalav has to be kosher meat and kosher milk.
Basar b'chalav. So, quick question, guys. Did anybody find any
set of
keys here, either here or nowhere?
I think my wife thinks. How many keys?
It was close to that. It might have been like maybe like 4 or 5.
Oh, not like a whole ring. Yeah, most likely is go to the end and
Ray Wasserman is on the left.
Okay. The back corner, he would more likely to know. What? Oh, okay. But yeah, so that would be, right, so Meat and Mill, because they're both independently kosher, right, has the same, right, has the same issue. I remember once in high school that we asked, you could engineer a situation where this is not true, right? Where Meat and Milk is bedilei in Sheminei, and then you got to figure out what you do. No, but it's normal for you to have meat and normal for you to have milk, and therefore, if you're in the middle of eating milk, right, you might not think to separate yourself from kosher meat. So that's not what we assume in halacha, and that's why you have to have separate tablecloths or some sort of heker to remind you that you're in the middle of a milk meal if you're at meat or vice versa or whatever. For example, because you're right, you wouldn't have a cheeseburger, but if Kobe is having a burgers bar and Mordechai is here snacking on M&Ms or it needs to be something snacky. Otherwise, I would say ice cream, but, you know, he's not. I don't think Kobe's just taking a spoon into your ice cream. But whatever, he has a bowl of M&Ms, right? He might just forget, right? No, very good. So no, right? So the halacha is only by makirin. Very good, Abi. Right? The halacha by Basar Bachalev is only by makirin. If you're friends, right? If you're friends who would normally share food, then you need to. Then you need some sort of. Right, so that was the question I had when I was in high school, right? Was that one of my very, very good friends, right? We would share food in general, but not meat or milk, because I'm a vegetarian, so I didn't share his meat, and he had a anaphylactic level allergy to milk, right? So the question was, could we eat together? And then we ended up being roommates, right, in YU. What? No, meaning I would have what I had, he would have what he had, and the only thing we could share were his Mike and Ike's. You know, like that was like the extent of what we would share. I mean, in the end of the day, formally, we would still have to separate because there's no like halachic status to vegetarian, to a health condition there might be, right? If I was like allergic to meat, that would probably be different, right? But yes, you're exactly right, right? So the Radbaz says those are the three factors, right? So let's just read it inside quickly. He says, "Sha'altemeni, you ask me, Odiyecha dati, manishana chametz bePesach mikol isurin shabbat Torah. Why is chametz different from all their prohibitions?" Right? Even though you guys are completely right, but because you're struggling with the Hebrew, I'm going to read through it quickly so that you see if you got it right. Okay? Shechmira alav Torah, that the Torah was stringent about it. Lahatzvicho bidika, to require searching, v'seiruf, and burning the chale and destruction, the gam bitul, and even after you searched and destroyed it, you have to nullify it. V'hosifu chachamim latzicho bidika v'charinu v'stakin. And the chachamim added that you have to search in the corners, the nooks and crannies and the crevices. U'lechapes acharav u'lesharesheto michol gulav, to search it and to uproot it from your entire boundaries. V'avar alav v'valyir avalim atzayin. You can't own it, you can't see it, v'asru b'kol shehu, and it's prohibited even a slightest amount. V'eino mitbatel klal, and it doesn't get nullified. V'chumrot ka'elu lo nimtzu b'chol ha'isurin Shabbat Torah. And these type of prohibitions are not found anywhere. D'i mishum did be karet. So if you'll tell me, well, it carries with it karet, kare chilev, be very careful, it's not chalav, chilev, right, forbidden fats, right, vidam and blood, are also karet. And if it's because it's prohibited for benefit, there are many other things that are prohibited to benefit from. So, mixtures of things that grow in a vineyard, a ox which gored someone and is now sentenced to death, and many other things are also prohibited for benefit. And if it's because people aren't used to separating from it, kule shata, during the remainder of the year, harayayin le nazir dilo badil mine, a nazir for 30 days, let's say, is not used to separating from wine, v'hachadash, and the new grain, right? Any grain that is planted before, right, before the second day of Pesach, is Chadash until you pass Tetzayin Nisan. Dilo b'dilei min hatzvuos, you're not used to separating from grain. Kula shata during the rest of the year. Velo chamire kulei, and we're not so strict. So tshuva. So first thing, shnei dvarim ne'emru b'tshuva davar zeh. Achat. So what is he doing? So the reason he doesn't is because 9 days is a very late minhag. And in Sfarad, they don't even have it. Not eating meat. Right? The 9 days, right? I mean, you're right that Poskim do raise that, but he's not going to raise it. He's really Sfaradi. And so he doesn't hold the 9 days to begin with. It's only Shvush Kalbo. Well, no. Right. According to the Gemara, the only time you can't have meat is Suda HaMafseket, the meal before the fast. That's it. What? On Tisha B'Av. The meal before Yom Kippur, you can. The Suda HaMafseket. The meal going into Tisha B'Av.
The Gemara also says you can't eat on
Yom Kippur. Obviously, you can't eat on Yom Kippur or Tisha B'Av. No one. Anyways, so he says, okay. So the first thing he says is each of these factors, there are other prohibitions that share these factors, and nevertheless, they're not as strict. So what's his first attempt at an answer? All three. If this is a quantitative, right? This is a quantitative point, right? Everything else has one. This has all three points. Yes. Okay, but nothing else has three. Three. He has three. Okay, quite, you know, it's a tipping point. I don't know. It says, Achat, Shalonim Subichal Yisrin Shabbatari Shistarfu Bo Shloshatana Ema Lalu, Shehu Yisurena, Vihu Bikaret, Vilo Bitilin Shemine Kulishata, Elachamitz Bilvad, the Chavan Shishba, Chumrod Alalu, and since it is all these stringencies, Yachmira Alav Torah Chumrod Acherot, the Torah makes other stringencies, Uval Chachamim Vosivu Chumrod Al Chumrod, Kimosha Asta Torah. And then the Chachamim add, Chumrot upon Chumrot, like the Torah does. So, good. Very good. So he first of all makes two claims. One is that Chametz is uniquely stringent because it has these three factors. Now, you're right, he doesn't explain why of all things, but he says the fact is that the conglomerate of factors makes it that it is stricter. And then he says, and then what does he say? But what does he say? Ichmira lav chumrot acherot. So what is he already telling you? That what does he believe? Very good. Right? So he tells you two things. One is that chametz gets more prohibitions because it is uniquely bad. And the second is that does he believe that there's such a thing as a two-tiered prohibition in the Torah itself? Yes, right? And then he even goes farther, and he says that, right, even though in many, many mitzvot in the Torah, we have rabbinic protective measures, what does he think is unique about the protective measures in chametz? Well, meaning what? Right, this isn't like every other prohibition. When the rabbis pile on chumrot on chametz, it's not just because of their general tendency to pile on protective measures. It's because they took their cue from God, right? From the Torah. The fact that the Torah itself seems to think that chametz is fundamentally so bad and itself layers prohibition. So yes, as Kobe notes, seemingly according to the way the Radbaz understands it, eating chametz is like the primary prohibition and the prohibition to own chametz is the Torah protecting itself. So it's a secondary biblical prohibition. And probably eating before Pesach, or the prohibition to eat chametz before Pesach on the 14th is probably another one of those. The Torah is actually layering it. And since the Torah does that, when the rabbis come and multiply that tenfold, they're actually taking their cue from God. Then he adds yet a fourth factor. And that is that chametz is Davar sheyesh lo matirin. Rav etu de chametz v'edam veiku davar sheyesh lo matirin. Now, what is a davar sheyesh lo matirin? or davar sheish lo matirin, what? That becomes mutter, right? Sheish lo, right? It can become mutter. So the general rule is that things that become mutter, even if they're not so strict, they're never nullified. They're not batel. For now, we'll stick with Rashi's reason, because Rashi says, why are dvarim sheish lo matirin, why are they not batel? Because you can just wait. You just wait until they become mutter, right? So something which is muktza, right? A food which is muktza. So why? It's not batel, because you can just wait till after Shabbos. Right. So you can't be mevatle, you just wait. Now this is actually not clear, because there is a machloket in the Gemara itself, whether chametz sha'avar alav ha-pesach, right? Chametz that has Pesach has passed through it, or it is passed through Pesach, is asur or not. We paskin is only asur midi rabbanan. So in principle, it's a davar sheyesh lo matirin, but even that is a machloket rishonim. And maybe we'll come back to that. But there is a machlok rishonim as to whether or not chametz is a true davar sheyesh lo matirin. But he says, "V'achra me'abezach yiyah chametz mutar ve'avo b'shita chametz shu meva'er e efshar sheyiyah lo heter elem ken yavor bevalir balimat." Say sov sov ikah chametz yiyah mutar lo. And then he says, "Well, it's not really davar sheyesh lo matirin, because the chametz which you destroy will not exist, but." Now he creates sort of a new category that chametz as a category becomes permitted, which is a very not obvious category at all. So what's his first argument, right? His first argument essentially twofold. Well, right, is what? Chametz is uniquely chamor because it has three different things that make it chamor. And therefore, point two, the Torah itself therefore layers the prohibitions, which three leads to the rabbis taking the Torah's cue and layering the prohibitions even more. And then he notes that maybe another reason to be machmir is the davar sheyesh lo matirin. Okay? But what's the problem? Matan, what's the problem? It was your problem. What's the problem? What has he not answered yet? Why? Right? Why? Right? He's described the situation, but he hasn't explained why. Right? Meaning he's described that the Torah treats you with unique sin. Right? Why? And his answer is because it is. Right? It's very strict, and therefore you get stricter. And that's why he says, "V'kasha li'ale the high time and he desagi high time of the inyan be'el the fuel be'elif lo batel k'davar sheyesh lo matirin da'arin and the fuel be'elif lo batel val pesach or the sarfo the sharsho." He said, "Listen, the fact that it doesn't become batel, fine, but the prohibitions by chametz are much more than that. You have to search it, uproot it. V'lo yadar lava. I haven't the slightest clue why." And he says, besides, now he backtracks on everything he just said. He said, Gam al tamarishon yishliksad gimgum. He says, "Umiyadif me'avodah zarah. Is it worse than avodah zarah? The amrat Torah lo yidbak v'yadcham umem menacherem v'chol amodeh b'kakova v'chol atorah." Right, avodah zarah is a big deal. You can't have anything to do with it. If you acknowledge avodah zarah, you are a heretic. V'lo matzino shetzricha Torah ba'bedika uvbitol elo shem eretz Yisrael mitzvah ledov acharav. As we talked about on Shabbat. In Israel, you have to chase after avodah zarah to uproot it. But there is no parallel, search your house for every possible little statue that is hidden in the, right? Put out 10 little idols before you, don't. Never do that.
Okay, so the issue I have with that is that, in a way, avodah zarah is more stringent than searching for it. Because the Torah gives you jurisdiction to search out through other people's property.
Okay, right. In Eretz Yisrael, you're right. You could negate this, and you could say, you could say, well, it's strict in a different way. I agree with you.
You could walk into a supermarket that literally, you could walk into a completely chametz bakery in the middle of Pesach and just sit there.
No, you can't. But nice try. No, you can't.
Why not?
Because it's Azar.
What's the... problems with that.
What's the logic?
What's the
smelling?
You can smell chametz.
You are not allowed to smell chametz for the sake of. This was a shayla last year.
Okay, I understand.
Right? You weren't overlapping, but we have a student from 2 years ago who's in culinary school in Drexel, right? And he called me before Pesach, what can you do? And this was part of the question, was can you... Yes, please. It's disgusting.
Yes.
What? I know, we should make a little book of all them, but that was one of them, yeah.
Okay, you can't go into middle bakery. You can walk in the middle of the bread aisle at a supermarket where all the bread is prepackaged and therefore you can't smell it.
Yes.
And just look at it all. But you have no obligation.
If that was a Avodah Zarah, you'd have an obligation to destroy it.
Well, only in Eretz Yisrael, but yes.
If that was a Avodah Zarah, you'd have an obligation to destroy it. But
correct. I agree with you. Right? You could push this back and say, okay, no, Avodah Zarah is stricter. Now, the truth is, if something is less strict than Avodah Zarah, that really...
Doesn't mean much.
Okay, I mean, sure. You said the... Well, whatever.
I mean, so what if there is a bakery in your local supermarket and there's no good way to get around being near it?
See, you think like the Gemara. And you know what the Gemara calls that? Ef shar velo kamachave. Right? There's no other way and it's not your intent. And you know what the halacha is? Mutter.
Okay.
Very good.
So it's considered a situation where you...
Correct.
Is that similar to like when you're walking along the street and someone's like automated light turns on?
Possibly. Yes, this is the key sugya. It's a very complicated sugya in the second perek. And if you would like, we can do it later in the year. It's a wonderful sugya in the second perek. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Not for now. So at the end, the Radbaz says, I give up. The Radbaz says, you know what? What does the Radbaz say at the end? The Radbaz says, okay, you know what? Nothing I said is sufficient. You totally missed what he said. What did he say? What does the Radbaz say? I know the answer. And that is?
Yitzhara. Right?
What Yitzhara?
As in, it said there's like the Yitzhara.
That Chometz is the Yitzhara.
Right, it is, yeah.
That's what he's saying. He's a Kabbalist, man. Kabbalist. So the Gemara, so here's what he does. The Gemara in one place describes the Yetzer Hara as the Sa'or Sheva Isa. Okay? As the leavening agent in the bread. It's a mashal. Based on this, the Kabbalists go very far and they say, aha! Chametz is symbolic of, an instantiation of, a manifestation of the Yetzer Hara. And that's why... Now, to me, when I read this conceptually, what I read is, I don't know, but what is the Radbaz essentially saying when he says that? What is he essentially telling you? Yeah, meaning, why is Chametz so bad? Because whether or not you want his particular formulation. What's the difference between his first set of answers and his second set of answers? Meaning, the first set of answers, what he's saying is, look, chametz is not fundamentally different than other prohibitions. It's just that, quantitatively, it is different than other prohibitions because it shares the most stringent qualities of a lot of other things, right? And therefore, the conglomerate of those factors makes it that we treat it worse. The second part of it is saying, no, you know why chametz is different? Because it is, in fact, sui generis. It is actually unique in that it is, I remember when I was in Rosenzweig Shir. What the Radbaz is telling you is that it is metaphysically noxious. Okay, right? There is something insidious about chametz, fundamentally, and why, therefore, now, in his first one, and I want to just be very careful, in his first formulation, he's very clear that There's primary prohibitions, and then there's secondary prohibitions, which are essentially siagim that the Torah itself put up. What about in this formulation? I'm not sure, right? Because it could be that he's saying because it's somehow metaphysically noxious, that's why you need protective measures. Or exactly, right? It could be that it's not protective. It's just that it is so noxious that each of these independently, right, it deserves multiple primary prohibitions that expel it from your presence at the same time. So let's just read his lines. He says, "Mikol makom harei ata ro'eh shelo ichmir et Torah ba'akum kolav chametz." Even avodah zarah is not as strict as chametz. Matan's point notwithstanding. Hilkach adayin sarech ta'am. V'alken ani somech amash amru chazal b'midrashot ki chametz b'pesach remez liyetzer hara. Chametz, only on Pesach for some reason, hints at, alludes to the evil inclination, or sheba isa, because the evil inclination is itself metaphorically described as the leavening agent in bread. V'lachain, and therefore we say, kale, destroy, gareshi garesh, thou shalt, you shall surely drive out otoa adam me'alavi, chapes alav, v'chol machva'on machshavotav, and search out in your thoughts, v'afilu kol shelo batel v'areze emet v'nachon, v'nir l'fi yomei da'ati katav. Yeah. This is strong language. Okay. That's the Radbaz. Yes. No. Yeah. So Kasha's, yeah. No. Presumably not. Hello, Tzvi.
Yeah, why so, one of the
people don't know who you are yet. Say hi, Tzvi. Because someone before was asking me a practical question about his tefillin, whether he should be worried about it starting to crack. I was like, I don't know the leather, but maybe you know better. I know, but you still might know. The answer is that you don't, but okay. I was like, if anyone knows it, you know. Okay. Thank you, T. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. What do you want from me?
I don't know. Okay. But that is the Radbaz. Now, the Radbaz is focusing on the question of stringency. Rabbi Yosef Engel is focusing specifically on the question of what?
Of why?
Of is there such a thing? Okay. The Radbaz is asking the question of is there such a thing as a siag la Torah from the Torah, right? Imatinu siag b'daraita. So, surprisingly, his answer is, yes, because how many proofs does he tell you he has? 17 plus 2. Good. 17 plus 2. He's less convinced of 2. Okay, so 17. So, he has potentially 19 examples of this phenomenon. So, for example, I was debating, should I just give it all to you? That would be 10 single-spaced pages. And then I said, no, I'm not going to do that, because Avi would say, what, that much Hebrew? No, to be fair, I would say, really, I have to read that? I mean, I have read it, but, you know. So, before we look at this one, right, he gives some other examples, such as, there is a general prohibition of, according to the Rambam, this is biblical, according to the Ramban, it's not, of kirva la'arayot, of becoming close to prohibited sexual relations. Right? So, potentially ichud, but probably more hugging romantically, kissing, right? Exactly what falls within the prohibition, right? We can quibble about. But right, the Rambam counts that as a biblical prohibition, and the simplest understanding of that prohibition is that it is a siag for the prohibited sexual unions of the Torah. Right? I mean, that is like a very straightforward one. If you think there is a separate biblical prohibition which prohibits you from
right? From doing, being engaged in romantic, non-directly sexual activity with the prohibited sexual partners, right? That sounds very much like a dad. Go right there. So he points to chametz as one of his potential ones. If you look where he says aleph, he quotes the Ran in the beginning of Pesachim, and he says, why does chametz uniquely have a mitzvah to search for it? So the Ran says, well, it's to enable you to fill the mitzvah of tashbitu. That's possibility one. And if you'll say, and we're going to see this tomorrow, that the reason for bedika is so you don't end up eating, which we'll see is Tosfot. We'll see tomorrow. Tosfot thinks that the reason you do bedika is to make sure that you don't accidentally eat the chametz that you left in your house on Pesach, even if you were bavatlit. And he said, combine that with the fact that chametz is something you're used to eating. So the first two answers of the Ran are, why is there bedika? Does it have anything to do with siag or the chumra of chametz? No, it's very practical. Why do you have bedika? Possibility one is, you have a mitzvah to destroy it. So in order to destroy it, you need to find it. Possibility two is, even if it was mutter to have chametz in your house, right, because you were mavatel or something, you might eat it. And we don't want you to accidentally eat it, so we tell you to get rid of it. So it's very practical. That's the first two answers. But what's his third answer? What's his second reason? Like the Radbaz, which is, we obligate you to search for it. Why did the rabbis institute an obligation to search? Because the Torah said, now, what exactly does that mean? So that can be understood, I think, in either way of the Radbaz. Either the fact that the Torah tells, right, the first set of answers in the Radbaz was what? Because the Torah itself clearly recognizes a primary prohibition and a secondary prohibition, the rabbis took their cue from the fact that there's a siag d'oraita and built even more protective measures. And that's what bedika is. It's a protective measure on the Torah's protective measure, right? So bal yira bal yimatze is a protective measure on eating, and bedika is a protective measure to enable, to ensure. So in his second one he says, "Mibnezet." I'm saying his third answer. The Efshar, third answer. His third answer, which is the Chazal said you have to search for chametz because the Torah says "Bal yira bal yimatze." Right. So one way of taking that is like the Radbaz, that since the Torah itself layers the prohibitions, that shows you that the right way to approach chametz is by layering even more protective measures. Or you could take it like the second answer in the Radbaz, which is the existence of all of these prohibitions points to the fact that there's something anathema about chametz on Pesach. Anathema? No. You're killing me. You're killing me.
Like a specific restriction?
No. Thank you. It's something which is like, yeah, you just, okay. And then he quotes the Prima Gadim, who quotes the Radbaz, right? For the Nigla and the Nistar reasons of Bal Yira, okay? So here's the problem, right? Is that what is the implication of calling something a siag? That it's not, I mean, it might be a part of the mitzvah, but it's not what? It's not intrinsic. right? It's not intrinsic. Yes? Right? The key to any siyag is that it's not intrinsically bad. It is a protective measure for something else, which is intrinsically bad. But it itself is not. It's a guard for something else. And that is the simplest understanding of the Radbaz, right? What's the problem with that conceptualization? That it's d'oraita. And that is it obvious that you're allowed to say that something is purely a siyag in that sense, meaning that it is not intrinsically bad, it's just that it protects something else when it is biblical. Right? It's one thing to say that it's like, so krivel arayot is an interesting case, because on the one hand you'll say it's a protective measure against engaging in forbidden sexual unions. But on the other hand, you could also say, yes, it protects you from the forbidden sexual unions, but it may also be
a value
in of itself, meaning it's clearly worse to commit incest, but it's also pretty bad to romantically kiss your daughter, right? So even if that is a protective measure, right? So the question of whether a siyag d'oraita, even if it exists, is a pure siyag in the sense that it is only instrumental, right? And not in self prohibited, right? Or problematic, maybe is the better word. That's very unclear when you're dealing with biblical revision. That's his next paragraph. Va'od nira. D'lo levad sh'lo ta'aseh atar mitzvah mimilta adati bilet ba'lit be'lidei takala ki em gamken lo tatir b'feirush ma'aseh kazot. Yes. Right, so he says the Torah doesn't normally have protective measures and doubts. So he says, you know why the Torah doesn't normally itself establish protective measures? Because protective measures are fundamentally what gives protective measures their value? The context, their practical utility. And what is a good protective measure for one person might not be effective for somebody else. Right? And there, one second, he says, therefore, the Torah isn't usually in the business of setting up siyagim, because siyagim are instrumental, contextual, but not fundamental. Right? What you need one time is not another time. Like the Torah, like the Gemara sometimes says, it wasn't the right thing to do fundamentally, but the time needed it. And the Torah only talks about things that include all times and all places, meaning things that are, meaning intrinsically, right or wrong, right? Because they're true at all times and all places, not things that are contextual and instrumental. He said, so the Torah doesn't put up these fences, but what is the will of the Torah? That you yourself set these up, and that's why the rabbis do it. And therefore, the Torah can't usually set up protective measures because that defeats the purpose, which is you figuring out for you what you need. Right? And he says, the Ramban as a mitzvah of Kedoshim Tiyu. Now, what is Kedoshim Tiyu for the Ramban? A generic chiyuv, right? Chiyuv klali, al kol adam she'kadesh atzmo b'mutar lo. It's to hold yourself back from that which is permitted, v'yasu lo siyagim, and set up your own fences, k'vim mashet tzarich lo shelo yavo lidei yisur. Now that only works if what? If the mitzvah of Kedoshim Tiyu is to set up your own fences, that only works if the Torah leaves areas which are not fenced off, because you have to leave it to people's volition in order to get that value. I'll skip down two lines, and he says, "Umeata l'divrei haRambana nal pashut lo tatir haTorah b'firush milta d'takal odavar nisrach l'geder isur." to you. But if that's the case, the Torah will also never explicitly permit the siyag. Right? It won't explicitly prohibit it, but it also won't explicitly permit it. What? Well, yes, but certain things it does explicitly permit. He's hinting at a taz here, which I don't want to get too much into. But the taz says that anything the Torah explicitly permits, you can't prohibit, which is what he's getting at there. And then he says, "Va'od nireh shemash lo katva Torah isurim siyagim." Why doesn't the Torah normally put protective measures? Zehu ba'avur ki ilu ktavdem. And this is very important. He says, because if the Torah had written them, shuv harei hayu heim gamken isurim atzmiim, they would then transform into intrinsic prohibitions. Right, which would acharei she'asarta b'Torah, because the Torah prohibited them. Vishuv harei adam nitzra'ach lasot siyagim acherim, which would in turn require more layers of protective measures. Kevan shahaya bahem asorech, because then they would be necessary. Kmo b'tzemim rishonim. D'acharei she'asra Torah ma'aseh siyagim rishonim im kein ha'avira b'amareshave la'avirot atzmiot. Because then the siyag would itself be an avira, an independent avira. Mereshio, the kevan shigam elu siyagim areyasra Torah va'over aleim are over al divrei Hashem yitbarach, and by violating go against God. Imken haya davar efo yotze livli tachlid yisurim asiyagim. So then you would end up, right, with endless prohibitions. Kiarishonim ayutzrichin lishniim, because the first ones would require seconds. Shivershu gamkein betara, which the Torah would need. Veshuv ashniim lishlishiim, and the second would need third. V'chein leolam, and this would go on forever. V'chamuvan v'al karchach lo yachla ha-Torah lichtov yisurim siyagim klal klal. That's why the Torah avoids it. So what does he say? So what does he argue? Let's just get his argument. He says, on the one hand, there is a lot of evidence that the Torah does sometimes have siyagim d'oraita. On the other hand, it doesn't quite, because the whole point of a siyag is that it's instrumental and contextual and not fundamental. But what does he assume? That once the Torah... But once the Torah says something's asur itself, you can't look at it as instrumental. It must be actually asur, right? So this brings us back to the chametz question, because on the one hand, the evidence seems to point to layered prohibitions, eating, and then Bal Yamatzeh is protective on that. But on the other hand, there's rabbinic prohibitions protecting the biblical prohibitions that we just said are themselves protective. So how do we deal with it, right? So what models do we have, right? Okay, so what do we have? The Radbaz, what does the Radbaz think? The Radbaz thinks that the Torah, in his first formulation, thinks that the Torah can layer things, right? That just because they're both d'oraita doesn't change the fact that one is primary, one is secondary. And what about Yosef Engel's problem, which is, well, doesn't that set up a situation in which the prohibitions will be endless? Yeah. What's his answer? Yeah. Yes, and that's where the Chazal got their cue, that if the Torah created an infinite regress of prohibitions around chametz, then we should make it doubly infinite, right? That's exactly what Chazal are doing, right? The Radbaz says in Achanami, exactly, right? The Torah itself went out of its normal comfort zone and layered the prohibitions. That shows you how strict it is. And so we layered even more. But fundamentally, the proper way of looking at chametz, according to the Rabbaz, and answer one is that there's a primary prohibition, don't eat. There are biblical layers, and then there are rabbinic layers that took their cue from the rabbinic layers. That's Radbaz 1. Radbaz 2 is maybe that what? No. It's not that this is a layered prohibition. It's that the existence of so many fundamental prohibitions point to the fact that chametz is metaphysically unique, and therefore the way we treat it is just wholly different than any other prohibition. both of them recognize that chametz is unique, but one of them says that the stringencies are an expression directly of chametz's problematic nature, and the other says that no, right? Its problematic nature generates secondary prohibitions, which in turn leads us to add tertiary rabbinic prohibitions. Rabbi Yosef Engel, right, notes that on the one hand, there's evidence of model one, right? That chametz, the biblical prohibition, seem to be protective measures. But again, he doesn't like it because he thinks that to be biblical is to be fundamental, right? And therefore, he doesn't properly think that the Torah's prohibitions can be called siyagim, where he's uncomfortable with it because things which are biblically prohibited are themselves intrinsically problematic and therefore would require protections on the protections. However, again, the Radbaz's answer is yes. Yes, that's exactly the case, right? So what I wanted to show you here is two models, right? Two models of explaining the stringency of chametz. One, again, is to say that all that there really are layers, and the Torah itself has layers, and the reason we have even more layers on that is because we are layering rabbinic prohibitions on top of the biblical protections of the fundamental biblical value, Radbaz 1. And Radbaz 2 is to say, no, even though there are more and less strict Yisurim of Chametz, these shouldn't be looked at as primary and secondary Yisurim, but rather they're all expressions of a fundamental understanding that Chametz is uniquely bad. Right? They're not layered, they're just, right, more manifestations of that fundamental truth. Okay? Those are the two models that I want you to keep in mind as we go through some of the mitzvot like Bidika and the like, and how do we understand the rabbinic prohibitions and their relationship to the biblical law, right? And that's what we're going to do tomorrow already, starting with the first Mishnah, which is one of those rabbinic extreme mitzvot is Bidika. And one of the major questions to be shown him is, how is Bidika connected to the biblical mitzvah of Tashbitu, of destruction, right? And that's what we're going to start tomorrow, but I wanted you to have these two models in mind as we go into that, okay? Keep them in the back of your mind, okay?